Okay, topic is kind of broad because it touches on the subject of meaning, the meaning behind mishpos. Before I tell you anything on the subject, I just would like to share with you that if anyone has an interest in the topic, there is a book that you need to know about that will probably take you the rest of your life to go through, and I'm not exaggerating. And it's this little book here, and it's not because it's so many words that it would take you the rest of your life to go through, but rather, let me tell you the story behind this book. It was written in the 1800s in German by Rabbi Samson Frohlhirsch, and it was his first book he ever wrote. He was a young rabbi in his 20s at the time. He was in his first position in a small district in Germany where he had a lot of spare time because the community at the time was spread out all over the place, and a lot of people were not very observant, and he had a lot to take care of in the way of repair of Judaism at the time. The Orthodox world was declining, reform was on the rise, and sadly he had a lot of spare time on his hands, and he dedicated his time. He was a brilliant man who had already spent some time in a famous yeshiva studying with a famous scholar known as the Aruch Laner of Yaakov Edlinger, who was a major Rosh Hashiva, as well as a very broad-minded man who himself had a doctorate, this Rosh Hashiva, which was not strange for Germany at that time. Hirschman himself spent a year and a half at the university in Bonn and then got this offer for this position and left it, never got his degree, and was one of the few rabbis in Germany at the time that didn't have a doctorate. People were surprised because in Germany that was the culture then. But he was extremely, extremely scholarly, both in matters of the world as well as what was going on in the Jewish world at the time. And he fought two battles at the same time. He was angry at the old guard of the Frum, of the Orthodox world, for being stuck in their ways and not showing their own children and their community how vibrant and meaningful Judaism is. And as such, some people distanced themselves from him because they felt he was trying to shake up too many things. But he was determined to do that. His own father, tell you a little secret about this, this is a not too well-known fact. His grandfather was trying to save Jewry and his community. His grandfather was a major Talmud Chacham who brought in some Polish rebbes to try to revive the yeshiva in Frankfurt, where he himself grew up. And while his grandfather was a major Talmud Chacham, a major scholar, Hirsch's own father chose not to send little Samson Raphael Hirsch to that cheder in town. Rather, he sent him to public school and made sure that he would get his training in Torah from the community rabbis that his father was involved in bringing in, because he felt that same old, old school way of educating is not going to work anymore, and we need to have children that are aware of the world as well as profoundly scholarly. So he created his own little design for his own child's education, which turned out to be somebody who probably is the father of the entire day school movement and the concepts that we have today, making Judaism alive and vibrant for, I don't know if it's tens of thousands or more, thanks to that decision not to send this kid to Cheder. I wouldn't try that at home. I don't try this at home. It's not necessarily what I recommend, but it worked at that time in that place, and it's an interesting perspective on who Hirsch was and where he's coming from. His first book that he tried to write was this massive work called Chorev, which is all about the philosophy of the meaning of the mitzvos. And when he tried to, after he wrote the whole book, after years and years of working on this book, I think 9 years working on it, it was a massive two-volume thing, and now they shrunk it down and they condensed it. You need magnifying glasses to read this. But when he finally was ready to print, no publisher was ready to publish his book because they said, Jews don't care anymore, and you're talking about orthodoxy. Orthodoxy's dying. Forget it. So he had to go to a Gentile publisher to convince them to publish his book, and they too said, it's probably not going to take off. Prove to us that your book will sell. So he had to write another book, much shorter, which was going to be less costly for them. And that turned out to be the 19 Letters, which is the first known book of Hirsch, which made quite an impact on his generation. There were even some people who were, I guess you can call it the conservative movement at the time, there was no such thing yet, but in Germany the equivalent of that, who themselves got a little shaken up when they read that book, and it basically was Hirsch's blueprint for how he understood Jewish philosophy, Jewish history, and the meaning of life, as the Torah says it, in contemporary times. Hirsch even had somebody move into his house, somebody who got so shaken up by that book from that other world, that he became a student of Hirsch and moved into his house for about 6-7 months, named Gretz. Gretz couldn't last, he couldn't handle the rigorous schedule that Hirsch had plotted out for him. He ended up leaving and sadly became someone who battled with Hirsch in public forums in different scholarly writings. Hirsch has a whole years of fights with that old student of his who wrote, maybe you know, in English there's a book that's been translated from the German, A History of the Jews, which professes all kinds of heretical things from that same Gretz. But Hirsch's once student, Gretz, came as a result of that book, The 19 Letters. It's a little history of who we're dealing with. There's someone who was dealing with the core, with the crux of a whole shake-up of Judaism at the time, and his whole life's goal was to show meaning and depth behind what is Judaism. That's full background. But today we're going to talk about what seems to be completely disconnected mitzvot, and there's a theme there. The Torah connects them, so there's clearly a theme. And Hirsch is one of the few that I know of that consistently goes into the core of every mitzvah, goes into the original sources, and doesn't just fluff it and say nice things that sort of sound right. But the more specific details he can get out of the details of the halacha, of the law, the more he deciphers what is the message and the theme with all the connecting pieces. So he has a whole section in this book which he divides all the mitzvahs into different parts. I think he has 6 sections. One of them he calls chukim. Now chukim, you were probably taught in school, means mitzvahs that we don't know the reasons of. That's not Hirsch's spin on that section. He has his own dictionary for these terms, and he calls chukim something far a little different. In the book they translate as follows: laws of righteousness towards those beings which are subordinate to man, animals or physical things under our control, towards earth, plant, animal, towards one's own body, mind, spirit, and word. He's got a whole section about laws of the Torah which talk to how we are to treat the environment that we live in, as well as treating ourselves as part of God's environment and our responsibilities towards ourselves, our body, and even our environment that we put ourselves into. So you'd have to see all of the entire section, and there's about 40 pages, I'm not going to do that today, as to how the whole theme goes. But before we talk about the ones that we built today, which are the Shatnas and some laws of Kashrus, and a few more that are connected in that immediate few verses, let me share with you that the very first mitzvah that Hirsch chooses to talk about in this section is the laws of Baal Tashkis, don't waste. Now, it wasn't the hippies of the 60s that came up with the concept of caring about the environment and being everything organic and environmentally friendly. The Torah talks about not being wasteful. The original place in the Torah talks about when you're waging battle and you have an opportunity to lay siege to the city, but they're hiding out, and sometimes among the trees and the shrubs, you may want to chop down some of those trees around the city to get a better view, to maybe get a better shot at your enemy, and while you may be allowed to wage that battle, if you have an opportunity to chop down 2 trees, and one is the fruit tree and one is a non-fruit tree, just a barren tree, you have no right, if all things are equal, you have no right to chop down the fruit tree. So it seems, you know, my mother told me every time I wanted to not finish my food on my plate, you know, it's wasteful, you really should have that, and that's the standard understanding of that mitzvah. Hirsch points out that it's far more than that. In this whole developing concept, he says that we have a responsibility to our world because the world was put here for a reason. And it's not just because those minerals are there for you. The nutrients in the food are, there for you. It's far beyond that. The concept of Al-Tashas, Hirsch takes it to a very, very intense extreme that I never thought of until I read this. If a person has something, in my house, my wife goes ballistic sometimes, and she gets into this cleanup mood, where it's enough stuff lying around, we've saved these things for too many seasons, she goes to the closets, and we have bags and bags of stuff that go usually at the Purple Heart. Very nice, Purple Heart, whoever's getting it, you know, God bless America, our soldiers, are, somebody's getting it, it's good for the world. And I came across this sentence in Hirsch's essay on Baltashas about not being wasteful, where he says that if you have something that's still useful for you, and you're just discriminately getting rid of it, or indiscriminately getting rid of it, that too is wasteful. It's true that someone in the world is going to use that. But you will no longer have that available for you. And who's to say that you have a right to dispose from your sphere that God gave to you, that you could just eliminate that? Who's to you were given things in your world. Maybe they're for you. Now, if it's, the thing's out of style, and it's from the 1960s, maybe it's time to get rid of it, because then it's not even usable for you. But if something's like two seasons out of date, and it's not really, it's pretty good, it looks fine, you're just not in the mood for this anymore. And you know what? It's a mess, and I gotta clean up. Let's just get rid of everything. And even if someone else will use it, Hirsch calls that wasteful. Because in your world, it was still usable. And he says that even worse than that is someone who has something and doesn't even use it for himself. And doesn't give it anyway. A person who's miserly. He has money. He has a beautiful home. He has possessions. But somehow he just can't bring himself to use it. He just saves everything. He hoards. He has collections all over the place. He's got, you go to his house, it's a museum. Everything just sits there unused. That too is wasteful. He hasn't destroyed it, he hasn't thrown it away. But that was, it was put on this planet for a purpose, and he's choosing to just let it sit there and stagnate. So that just gives you a sense of how Hirsch looks at the world. That everything is far beyond our little world that we live in. There's a bigger, more global purpose to existence, and it's our responsibility to interact with that world. It's not for today, maybe another time I'll develop it in another class, but the whole, everything that Hirsch speaks about is connected to his theme of Torah in Derech Eretz. The term Derech Eretz is misunderstood by many people. Some people think it's Hirsch talking about that it's okay to go to college, which he certainly, in his circumstance, said it is, and would likely, under certain other circumstances, say it would be today, depending on how you do it. But it's far, far, far beyond that. The word Derech Eretz has lots of meanings. It doesn't just mean behave yourself and be a nice person. Derech Eretz also means what's in your world today. The world as we know it. And Hirsch understands that God gave us a world, and it's our responsibility to have godliness thrive and pump through that world. There's a reason why there's a world. God didn't have to make a world if he didn't want to. And we are charged with the obligation of using that world and uplifting it, making it holy and purposeful. So we're going to come to this concept of your possessions that you own. If you neglect those items that are there, you've just abused God's world. It's, you may as well have just not been born if the things that he gave you to uplift and make them holy and make them purposeful in God's eyes were just done away with, or you downgraded it. You gave it to somebody else to use, but you don't even understand that you're supposed to be using them and uplifting them. Then you missed the whole point of why God gave you those things. But with that in mind, and college would be the same thing. It's a world that we live in. It's the here and the now. And with the right kosher environment, the right way to do it, God wants you to be in that world and uplift it. Let's talk a little bit about the subject that we're going to talk about today. A lot of introduction. There is a pasuk in the Torah that tells us, it lumps a whole bunch of mitzvahs together. And they are Kilai Behema, not breeding animals together. Kilai Ilan, Zroim, Vakerim, not grafting trees or certain shrubs together, or let's say Torah talks about wheat and grapes, not being grown in too close proximity. Not plowing different animals, an ox and a donkey together, or using the same yoke. Shatnez, and the prohibition against mixing milk and meat. They seem to be so disconnected from one another, these concepts. Yeah, people often talk about, if you look at some of them alone, so some people would say, you just think about the mitzvah of not having your two different animals together, an ox and a donkey. Well, maybe it's cruel to the animal, and one can't keep up with the other one. If that were so, if that was the purpose behind, or the meaning behind that mitzvah, then why would it be lumped together with shatness, not mixing wool and linen in your garments? What does one have to do with the other? or not mixing milk and meat together. Or some people would say, if you just looked at milk and meat, the prohibition of that isolated, they would say, maybe it's a health factor, or somehow it does something to your body. If that were so, there would probably be a lot of other health halachas that are out there that never crept up. And why would that be lumped together with shatnez or other things of that sort? What's the connection? So, with that alone, Hirsch, and he has a whole piece on the Torah about this in the early chapters of Genesis, he talks about the concept of minehu. God made things, each thing has its own place in existence. Animals were made a certain way, and they naturally, when left alone, will cohabitate with their own type. They don't mix around. It's true that human beings can impose themselves on some animals. So you can make a mule. If you work hard enough, you can make things happen. You can graft things. You can force yourself on certain parts of God's existence and make them sort of work it out together. But before we get into anything, God's saying, I made a world and there's a reason behind everything. You may not understand those reasons, but everything's got its place, its order. And don't mess with my world, because you don't even understand. If you're out of sync with the world, you're gonna be out of sync with your own existence. There's a reason why it's there, and it'll help you be in the flow of how this world works. So he says that in Chorev, and he says it briefly in an introduction to these verses in the Torah. But he takes the concept far beyond that. That's just one thought, and that's in general, all of Chukim, all of these mitzvahs that we may not know the reasons of, that itself, if God said so, there's something behind it that's more profound than I know, and certainly I'll accept that. But in his attempt to try to see a rhyme and a reason behind this, he develops something very, very eye-opening in the whole correlation between particularly shatnez and milk and meat, which we'll elaborate on. If I were to ask you, what does a plant do? You could have a conversation with a plant. And you ask the plant, what are you busy doing all day? So what would the plant tell you back? What is a plant busy with? Or what does a plant do? Any volunteers? What is a plant busy doing all day? No volunteers?
It grows.
Okay. What else does a plant do? Grows? That's true, it grows. Okay, it's letting off and it's taking it. So you just said it's taking in, it's taking out. Right? It's taking in nutrition and it's breathing in its way. So, anything else a plant does? It's absorbing. Okay, it's taking in. It's taking in water. It's taking in sunlight. It's taking in whatever plants need to take in. It's growing. And it reproduces. And that's about it in the life of a plant. It's a pretty lame existence. They eat and they reproduce. And that's about all there is in the life of a plant. And for us it is. Oh, that's what we do. But that's some of the plants doing. You know what I'm saying? What does a plant in his personal life do? You know, in the life of a later, he works for a pharmaceutical company. Well, that could be interesting. I'm not sure which plants you're referring to.
Many of them
themselves. Right, and the jungles of the Amazon, right. So, now let's talk about an animal for a moment. Animals have some things above and beyond what a plant. They also eat. They also reproduce. What else does an animal have above and beyond the plant? Any thoughts? Okay, they interact. How do they do that? They have a mind. Alright? Plants don't have brains. Animals have the ability to think. What else does an animal have over and above a plant?
Ambulatory.
Thank you. Very good. Okay, we got some thinking people here. Plants can move, animals can move. So those are the two things that animals have over and above a plant. They can think, they can move. Okay, what does an animal do with those extra features that they have? The fact that they can think and move, what do they do with that?
They hunt.
So they hunt, they eat. So they're better plants. They're essentially what an animal does with its gifts that are over and above a plant is it becomes a better plant. It's a sophisticated plant. It can think, therefore it says, where will I find my mate? Where will I find my food? It can move, so it goes to mate, it goes to eat. And that's where it ends. So those extra gifts of an animal do really no more than make it a fancy plant. Now, where does a human fit in to this pattern? We also can think, we can move, and if you go to certain classes, they'll tell you we are no more than the top of the rung of evolution, and we too are no more than animals. Well, if that's true, then essentially our goal in life is no more than to use our added cognitive abilities. Of course, we're so smart, we can eat even better. And we can find other ways to entice ourselves and have more fun. And touch our nerve endings in a fancier way. So there's a danger when the animal side of a person becomes too enmeshed with his plant side. Now, when I say plant side, I simply use it as a buzzword for eat and reproduce. That's essentially all growing beings have that vegetative side. When we take our cognitive abilities as a human, which should rise above the animal, and we use it for no more than animal, we have simply taken what should have been elevating and uplifting, as I started to introduce the concept of Dorm Derech Eretz to you, taking the physical world and using it as an opportunity to come closer to God. We've done exactly the opposite. We've taken our free will and our abilities and we've put it right in the gutter. So says Hirsch that the mixing of linen and wool are no more than a symbol of warning, of beware of this concept. In our clothing, we represent our personalities. Everyone has their uniform, and it really is it's a statement to the world of what they are, what they relate to. You can look at a person and see what they're trying to tell you by just how they look. And they're saying something. When we cloak ourselves in a symbol, which is the meshing of the animal and the plant world, watch out. Why did he pick specific? Why did God pick wool and linen? I can't tell you for sure. Somebody once told me, and I really meant to look it up before this little class, and I forgot to. I was told once. If you know it to be true, please let me know. That NASA once did an experiment. I don't know why they chose this, but they took a piece of fabric with wool and linen. They brought it up to space, and they pulled themselves apart naturally without it being in our atmosphere. I don't know why. What I read was that wool is, if you want to build if you want to make a nice fabric, one that's really going to provide a lot for humans, you would think to have wool and linen, because wool is nice and warm, and linen is strong. So those are the two. If you were to set out to design a nice hefty piece of cloth, you would think to do those two. But those two, of all things, represent the animal kingdom, right? That's the wool, and the linen is the plant world. And they're enmeshed. And when they entangle themselves, and you cloak yourself in that, you're giving yourself a symbol that the animal and the plant are no more than one harmonious set. Well, that's good for animals. That's not good for us. Humans need to say to themselves, life is bigger, life is deeper than that. And he says the same thing when it comes to meat and milk. Meat represents the animals. What is milk? Milk is that part of an animal that's its vegetative side. It's where the animal nurtures its offspring, and it's a symbol of its own reproduction and its own continuing its own species. When we eat food, we're taking in something which gets integrated into our personality. The Ramban talks about that with the prohibition of blood, that you have to be careful of what you eat because it becomes part of who you, your deeper, deeper self. So at least in one area there's a symbol. It's not that it's no health thing, and it's not even going to be relevant in all across the board foods that we eat, because if it was true that we shouldn't have salad with a piece of the steak. It's a symbol. And it's a symbol in an area where those two represent what we imbibe, particularly in the animal world itself. The animals themselves are animals and plant-like in their own bodies. The milk of an animal is itself the animal being vegetative. So mixing those two together and imbibing that into our own deeper personality symbolically is a danger zone. Watch out that the animal world of your side and your plant life don't become the two focal points of your existence and you forget to rise above and to elevate them. So that's just a small little concept, and really the truth is that it's life itself. We go through life and we can forget the most elevating moments of our life could be trivial if we don't take note of that. A person's driving in his car. You know, he can have that be an ego trip, look at this fancy thing I'm driving in, or he gets into his car. What an opportunity. Look at this great vehicle I have. 200 years ago, no one dreamt of such a thing. Look what I can do now that I have this tool in front of me. And then, this is a symbol. The next time you're in the kitchen and you're watching out for the milk of Lefleshitz and you're washing, if you remember the symbol, this is not about milk and meat. It's about life itself as you go through your day-to-day existence. Why am I here? What are the tools in front of me? Just these two items are just the just a small dose of what Hirsch has to say about all Torah mitzvahs. Really, it's all that, every day. So it's not just your food, it's not just your clothing, but those are certainly classic examples of what we do all the time. And there's many, many more like that. There's just a smattering. It's really, really wanted to say today. It's a short and sweet Dvar Torah, but sometimes saying too much, you've already said more than you need to. I think we all have what to meditate on. If you have any questions, I'm free to take them, but in my humble opinion, what Hirsch's messages are really, really relevant for this generation. They ought to be much more. So, Belin Eder, when I come here, whatever, a few times a year, I will attempt to only speak on Hirsch's topics because I think that someone needs to get the word out of what his profound messages are. So when I'm here, we're going to talk Hirsch. Okay, have a good day.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Saif, for the wonderful foundation for Rabbi Hirsch.
Right after the mitzvah of the Ahavta L'Recha Kamocha, love your fellow Jews and love your neighbor as yourself, right after that comes this mitzvah of all these combinations of things you should keep apart. And they're not even disconnected by a paragraph break. It's literally the next pasuk. So what's the connection between all the laws of love your neighbors? And another place in the Torah, it's right after the Mishpatim. After the whole code of civil law, the next thing we find is this prohibition against milk and meat. So he says that what we take for granted to be a general law of society or be nice is really, that too is an elevated existence. We don't have society behaving itself just because it works better for me. If you do that, then when it doesn't work better for me, then you really won't behave yourself. Societal laws are there because it's God's way of saying, this is how the world should look. Everything has its own place. And that guy has his money, and you have your money, and don't steal it. Not because it's not nice, and because if you break the law, one day he'll steal your stuff, so it doesn't work out well for you. But don't do that because he has his money, because he needs that. Everything has its own place, and you have yours because you need that. And be nice to the people. At the end of that passage, he says, I am God. What is the fact that God is God, the reason for why you should be nice to him? Because don't be nice to him so he's nice to you. Be nice to him because he has a purpose in his life. Everything has its function, its purpose. So with that backdrop, then it goes on to talk about how in our own personal lives, everything has its purpose. And therefore, don't make your human existence into an animalistic one, because I gave you more than that. You too have purpose, and a higher purpose. Okay, there you go.
First one.